Welcome to the School of Batman, a podcast where we ask academics to help Batman fight crime using their research. I'm your host, Chris George, amateur scientist and professional Batman enthusiast. In today's episode, we'll be discussing the rebirth of Blackgate Penitentiary. We're pleased to be joined by Victoria Knight. Victoria has a PhD in sociology from De Montfort University and is currently a senior research fellow for the Community and Criminal Justice Division in the Faculty of Health and Life Sciences at De Montfort University. So hi Victoria, thanks for joining us and how are you today?
I'm really well, thank you very much. Looking forward to our conversation.
The division that you work for now sounds like something from Gotham anyway, the Community and Criminal Justice Division. But, I mean, let's start at the beginning a little bit and talk about some of your early research and how you got to where you are today and what interested you and what led you to make some of the decisions that you took. So, broadly speaking, let's start with what sociology means and what interested you about it.
Sociology is a discipline which studies society and how society is organised and how society is shaped. And within sociology, it explores, I suppose, people's role in society and how society influences people and how people influence society. So, you know, it has a very broad application in terms of exploring the world in which we live. We can use it to look at our education system, our family units, our working lives, our criminal justice system, our health system, friendships, conflict. You know, its application is really, really wide. And what's great about sociology is that it gives you an opportunity to kind of look at the interactions between us humans and where it works well and where it goes wrong. And so it allows you as a sociologist to question why we do the things that we do in everyday life. You know, who's decided the rules? Who's decided that we, you know, drive on the left-hand side, for example? Where does that come from? And sociology allows you to explore, you know, these things that we often take for granted.
Oh, and you can interpret this question philosophically or technically or however you want, but what is a society?
A society is, I suppose, a collection of people that are enmeshed with conventions and rules and regulations and laws and legislation and policy. And there's lots of debate about what a society is and how big a society is or how small a society is. So many people in sociology kind of are really interested in, I suppose, cultures within that and, you know, differences between different jurisdictions.
One of the things that intrigues me about this kind of thing is this idea of a collective acceptance of a concept that doesn't, like, really exist in the real world. So it's not like we all agree that rocks are a thing, but like, we all agree that laws are a thing or money is a thing or religion is a thing. Is that always been there throughout history, that these ideas that there's a group of people that accept a collective kind of unreality in that sense? Or is that been more of a modern invention if you're looking at the span of humanity as a whole?
I think when I suppose we moved beyond the cave and we needed to operate in terms of exchanging goods and services, I suppose those sort of unwritten rules and conventions started to sort of pan out. And then I suppose we moved away from sort of quite a crude feudal system where, you know, things operated between, you know, people on the street or within a very short amount of space. In a small space, should I say, these conventions were agreed, and the consent that we give to society for things to operate, I suppose, have maintained. But of course, what's important in sociology when we think about the consensus is that we have some acceptance that, you know, the self, the individual, will benefit from consenting to, you know, agreeing to things like using money to exchange goods and services, for example. But then you've also got within that, you know, power structures, which are really important within sociology, and how power influences, you know, the masses. And that these power structures support and maintain an agenda that we have money and that we have a certain political or civic society and the rules and the conventions within that. I get what you're saying about reality, and I think we could argue all day about, you know, what is real and what's not. And I think, you know, what's interesting is that we have the power and the state who are upholding, you know, a civic society, but within that you have individuals and their personal struggles within that system are really, really fascinating. And all the time we see forms of resistance, people silently often fighting with the conventions within society, and that their ontological positions may differ radically from that of the state. So often we see forms of resistance routinely within our world, and this is not just about, you know, major conflicts. These are quite small and what sociologists call micro. But there's something about consensus and consenting to that kind of allows most people to operate within a civic society.
So what did you do for your PhD?
My PhD was a study of incel television within prisons.
And so that was kind of leading on to my next question, actually. With such an incredibly broad scope available to you within the field of sociology, how did you come to settling on the idea of prisons and justice and community? What was the path that led you there?
The path that took me to this is quite an interesting one. My first degree was a degree in media and politics. And my dissertation for that degree was a study of family viewing of television within the home. And what that did, by undertaking that study, and I engaged a number of families with young children, in that study, was to explore how television is negotiated within the home. And what I mean by that is that television isn't a neutral piece of technology. It's statistically abnormal for most families to not have a television. And so television is a central feature of the modern British home. And what it revealed, that study, was something quite interesting about the domestic space and how, for example, men and women view television is very different. So the link between my undergraduate dissertation to the prison was through an innocent conversation that I was having with a friend of mine that ended up going to prison. And I was writing to him at the time I was undertaking this study, and I was saying, you know, I'm doing my dissertation on this, and have you got a television in prison? And what's it like viewing it there compared to the home? So I began to ask questions about, you know, the differences of our viewing experiences depending on the place in which we view and use television. So what I then quite quickly did was put together a research proposal for a master's. My proposal was to look at how prisoners consume different types of media. Now, at that time, televisions weren't standard. I learnt from my friend that television wasn't a standard provision given to prisoners at that time. And prisoners had to comply with the regime and also comply in terms of behaviour to get access to televisions in their cells. So I thought that that was deeply fascinating in terms of how so I managed to achieve access to a young offenders prison that housed 18 to 21 year old male prisoners. And what was interesting, this was at the time that the state had just started to introduce television sets inside prison cells. Before that, television was consumed in communal areas. So I got access to this prison and I undertook my master's study, which didn't just look at television, it also looked at radio, use of print media, music, the use of the telephone as well. What I discovered was that the role and use of these communication opportunities were very, very important in terms of these people managing their time in prison, and the impact that it had on the social life in the prison. So the civic life in the prison began to change, certainly when televisions were being introduced. So when I completed that study, obviously the momentum of this in-cell provision was taking hold. I managed to secure a job as a junior researcher here at De Montfort University, and I was presented with the opportunity to undertake my PhD, and obviously it was down to me what that study was. The approach that I took was ethnographic, and what that means is that I wanted to spend time in the prison as much as possible, considering I was a visitor, to actually begin to deeply understand what we call the modes of reception in audience research. So to understand the context in which these prisoners were consuming in cell television. So I often interviewed prisoners inside their cells with the television switched on. So we talked about television whilst it was on. And I was able to kind of feel for myself that environment in which television is received within the cell. I managed to interview prisoners who lived together in a cell. So I'd interview one of them and then another one, and understand the dynamics and the relationships that these men were having with each other, with TV being part of their everyday lives. Prisoners tend to be behind their cell doors for between something around 18 to 20 hours a day. And TV for many people becomes in some sense a friend, an enemy. And so these complex relationships with, you know, what we would consider a neutral or innocent piece of hardware is actually plays a really important role in the life of the prisoner and for the prison.
We ask our guests to choose an actor to represent their Batman actor in their story, which we're going to do now. Have you chosen a Batman actor?
I'm going to be controversial and say Idris Elba.
I think he'd make an amazing Batman and an amazing James Bond, so I'm fully on board with that. Blackgate Penitentiary, the home of the sane criminals of Gotham, is starting to show its age. Recidivism is at an all-time high, and the behaviour within the prison has been deteriorating for years. The stark, crumbling cells and a total disregard for the prisoners engender a sense of dehumanisation amongst the guards, causes an air of constant tension. Wayne Enterprises is bought in the hope that they can bring a 21st century mindset to bring the situation under control. So this is Blackgate Penitentiary in Gotham, and the Blackgate we're imagining is something that I think a lot of people would imagine a prison to be. Very stark, very something that could have existed in the 1800s. You have your cell, you put your prisoner in your cell, and that's where they are, and that's kind of all they deserve. Now, I think this kind of leads on to another question that I'm interested in your opinion on, is with the introduction of things like technology into prisoners' lives and different forms of media, how much does the public perception of what that might be affect people who make these decisions in prisons, choices? How much is that taken into account?
It does. The public has an influence over the policy makers and the senior managers, the people that are in charge of the prison and justice system. Crime and punishment is an emotive issue. And often what that then means is that these emotions impact on rational decision making. The problem with our prisons is that often they get overlooked. And if we think about the average member of the public, they're a law-abiding citizen, working hard and paying their taxes. There's been some studies on public opinion and prisons. Often what we find is that the public are fairly ignorant about how prisons are run and how prisons are experienced. But what much of the public are able to establish quite quickly is that there's this, what they call the legitimacy argument, is that, is it legitimate that we provide our prisoners with often what is deemed as luxury items? They are there to be punished. What they don't recognise is that our prisons are there also as a space of rehabilitation. So this kind of limited view interferes with the decision making. It is political. So politicians want to, cut crime. Policy makers are often scared about making bold decisions.
This might be something that is you don't have experience of, but do you know much about how public opinion on these matters varies around the globe? Does it change kind of country by country, or is it a fairly uniform idea about luxury items and things like that are not there and they're there to be punished and things like that?
I think, broadly, there hasn't been enough research to compare opinion globally, so against different jurisdictions. And what we tend to find when we press the public about their views of prisons, what we tend to find is that the first priority for most of the public is that they don't mind their taxes being spent on prison as long as it leads to rehabilitation. As long as that's done safely and people aren't at risk of re-victimisation or committing more crime. We do know that attitudes towards incarceration do vary across different cultures. Scandinavia is often purported as a more humane prison and justice sector compared to areas with high incarceration rates, which UK is one of them, the US obviously, and also places like Russia and China. In the Netherlands, they're closing prisons down because they haven't got enough prisoners. It's not because the crime rate is lower. It is because they believe that actually deterring people or keeping people away from the prison system is better for society, and that often people who have committed crimes can be managed in the community. And the benefits of that mean that they can access opportunities and get on that rehabilitation path.
Did you find any interesting parallels between your study of how TV fits within family life to how TV fits within prison life?
Absolutely. So there's something called the social uses of television, and we don't just sit and watch television to get information. We use television for different social uses. So that is things like surveillance, so we know what's going on in the world. It's also part of our identity, and the kinds of television that we consume link directly to our own biographies. There's also the kind of sociality issue, this idea that, you know, soap operas, for example, are watched by thousands of people at the same time. So there's something around sociality, and that much of what we consume on TV allows us to connect to that bigger world, but also gives us substance for interaction and conversation. So, you know, soap storylines are beautiful for kind of that chat the next day. Did you see kind of moments? What's going to happen next? It's also about companionship, and many people switch their television on but don't watch it. And it's there in the background, and I read something beautiful about the idea that, you know, we don't have the open fire in the household anymore, but we've got this glow of the television set. And that was particularly striking in my study in the prison. Experiences of isolation and loneliness are commonplace, and many of the men I interviewed adjusted often what they were watching because they knew that their partner would be watching it at home, that they wouldn't choose to watch these kinds of programs. So it allowed them to feel connected and remind them of that the comfort of home. So in a sense, they're recreating the home within the prison. Also, when men share a cell, often it can create conflict. So they used to kind of, you know, take it in turns, and they found a way to negotiate that. But what was beautiful about this relationship, this dynamic, was that at the end of the day, they found something that they both enjoyed, and that was Star Trek. So despite their differences, they both discovered through living together in that very small and compressed environment that TV could actually bring them together.
Taking things back to Blackgate then, and how Wayne Enterprises might be able to help, with that kind of 18th century stark crumbling prison, I'm guessing the key problem there is one of boredom. So what kind of problems would that foster? What recommendations would you give as the head of Wayne Enterprises to senior management of Blackgate? And what kind of changes could we expect to see within behaviour, environment, that kind of thing?
The problem with boredom is, unlike being bored in the outside world, the problem with boredom is in prison is what it does, it intensifies that feeling. And I call it hyperboredom. Now, hyperboredom is dangerous. And it's dangerous not only for the prison environment, but it's also dangerous to the individual. So in order to address and overcome boredom, prisoners have, as I've explained, an inordinate amount of time to think, and many prisoners adopt, let's say, antisocial behaviours in order to overcome boredom. So they may well choose to undertake some bullying, engage in violence, take drugs, to kind of squash that time, compress that time. The root cause of boredom, of course, is what Gramsci called forced idleness. And what we often see is that our prisoners are subject to this forced idleness because our prisons are under-resourced. And this under-resourcing is problematic because instead of exploiting the time that prisoners have at their disposal, there's very little activity, purposeful and meaningful activity. in addressing that, I think I've painted a picture of, you know, how much time is spent behind those cell doors. And Blackgate, you know, only has a limited amount of money available, so unlocking those prisoners can be expensive. But as we've seen in the outside world, we're seeing now a society or a situation where we are in a digital world, and we are operating in what some people would call a smart society, where technology is woven into our everyday lives, and it's quite difficult to, you know, get basic tasks done without engaging with some kind of technology. This is starkly different in our prisons. And so one of the things that I would propose is a plan to get our prisons smart. What that will allow Blackgate to do would be to make use of that time behind their cell doors. So to get people behind those cell doors accessing information, resources, connecting with people such as friends and family, staying in touch with friends and family, not just on the occasional visit when they come to see, but also on top of that, you know, having a conversation with their son and daughter before they go to bed, we know helps people rehabilitate and resettle much better when they leave society. So those family links and those social connections are also important. What I would say is that a smart prison could be a prison that exploits technology to lead the prison towards a path to enable people to rehabilitate and get on the path of desistance, but also to resettle back in society. So get people in prison to start applying for jobs, preparing their CVs, planning and organising their own finances, opening a bank account, for example. What we also have with technology is a really key tool for staff as well, so that they can begin to work closer with the prisoner. And what I found with television, that once the television was introduced to the cell, that the prisoner retreated from public life. And there is a danger that that could, of course, happen. So technology could be used as a way of staff and prisoners interacting and communicating. Like we send our colleagues emails at work, could that not be engaged in the prisoning environment as well? So keeping people safe, we can use technology to help people keep safe. The use of cameras, for example, when somebody's feeling low, a route to communication for help when they're feeling lonely and isolated. So the smart prison is what we have in the outside world, but what we're doing is we're applying that to the prison setting. But it has extraordinary benefits to, you know, the prisoner and the prison. Healthcare is also important, you know, helping people stay healthy. How wonderful would it be that, you know, whilst people are inside their cells, that they can access fitness programs, for example, or do a bit of yoga, and using things like, you know, videos to, you know, prompt people to engage with that. But also education, you know, the amount of knowledge that's available now online, for example, and e-books. You know, it is unlimited, really, in terms of the opportunities that we could allow our prisoners.
So that's it for today. Using the latest technology in smart prisons, Wayne Enterprises will hopefully bring Blackgate to a new era. Thanks very much to Victoria for joining us.
Thank you for listening.
And you can find out more about Victoria and her work on Twitter at VicKnight18 and on LinkedIn. Both links will be in the description of the episode. If you'd like to be a future guest on the podcast, please email us at info at figshare.com. And you can find us on Twitter at School of Batman.